Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the Soul Sisters podcast for Billboard. I'm Jessie Katz here with my co-host Dara Golub, and we are feeling pretty good about the episode we recorded today because it's just one of those chats that makes you feel like, I don't know, we're kind of all in this together and everyone's awesome because our guest today was awesome. Her name is Alexis Krauss. She is half of the band Sleigh Bells, and she stopped by for a lovely chat about how she came up in music and how they defined this crazy sound that they created and what's coming up for them in 2016. A lot of exciting stuff. So let's get to today's episode with Alexis Krauss.
So how long has that friendship been going?
Well, Bethany and I... It was funny. We've existed in the same circles for many years. I feel like our bands have always sort of been like sister bands in the sense that we started getting attention around the same time. There was even a weird coincidence between my bandmate Derek and Bethany where when he first came up from Florida and was looking for somebody to work on music with, she was in a band called Pocahontas, and he had actually approached her about joining what was to become Sleigh Bells, and she was kind of like, yeah, I got this thing, like, I don't know you, sort of. It didn't work out.
Oh my God.
Then he ran into her, I think it was at Coachella, and was like, hey, remember me? And she was like, holy shit.
That's crazy.
So
your lives are very intertwined.
Our lives are very intertwined, but we, for many years, just never met. We never crossed paths at a festival. It was always like she was playing on Friday, we were playing on Saturday. And
she's like West Coast.
Exactly. West Coast, right. East Coast, yeah. For sure. And then I guess a couple months ago, I can't really get into too much detail, but I was approached.
As much as you can get.
Yeah.
Right. I run a blog that's dedicated to sustainable alternative cosmetics and skincare products. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in one ingredient in particular, which is called shea butter, and it's produced by women in West Africa. So we are working on a project that raises awareness about shea butter production and women's empowerment in West Africa through fair trade and the connections between the U.S. market and Ghana and women making things for women. So I was looking for a partner in that venture. Mm-hmm. And Bethany just kept coming up in my mind because she does so much work with women here in the United States, and she's an outspoken feminist and just think a general badass. And so we know people that know each other, and we were connected. And the rest is history. And we ended up doing this like funny thing out in California, which was the first time we hung out. And then we were in Ghana together, like bonding.
Oh, so you still hadn't met her.
We had met, but we hadn't spent like a ton of time together.
Yet.
Right. We had like a very, you know, rich email relationship.
Right.
But yeah, so we did some serious bonding in Ghana, and that's kind of all I can say at this point.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll
because
be
things will
her.
Be coming out.
Things will be coming out. Okay, exactly.
Cool. Bonding in
exactly.
Ghana. Yeah. Yeah. I like it.
Right. How long were you there? Can you tell us that?
We were there for about a week.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. And
should
I'll
be like
be
the name
at
of
her...
a podcast.
Bonding in Ghana.
Bonding in Ghana.
Today with Alexis and Bethany.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was, it was great. And so I'm going to her T5 show tonight, which I'm excited
Excellent.
About.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at so this early. Day. It's a great day.
So great. So we're all well. Just friends hanging out. Yeah. Friends upon friends.
And Bethany and I have the same tour manager too, which is hilarious. So it's like,
how does that work? All,
it, we've just, we haven't been on tour and they've been on tour. Okay. So it's great. Yeah. It's like everybody just sort of shares awesome crew guys and gals. So
is that because you guys are recommending people to each other?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's such, it's a pretty incestuous world, the music business, as yeah. you know. So it's not uncommon to be like, oh, who does front of house? I'm like, oh, you know
right.
him. Like,
right.
oh, she does monitors, whatever. So
totally.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here.
This of course.
This is like super exciting because I just feel like I haven't met you before, but you're like a cool person that seems like you're a perfect fit for the show.
Great,
so I'm
great.
Glad we can chill here for an hour and get to know each other.
I'm honored.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about your own badassery because you certainly have your credentials in that area. I think because of the kind of music that you make, people probably expect a certain like badass vibe to walk into the room.
For sure.
But you seem to have a chiller vibe.
Yeah, then I walk in like so with a bike sweet. Helmet covered in dirt.
I'm like, right, hey, exactly. So are you channeling something inner into that music? Or is that just like the art brain is that?
I think it's more about the art brain. I yeah. think for me, music has always been sort of transformative. And one of my favorite things about music is that you can exist as a relatively introverted, quiet, reserved person, and then you can hear music or play music and totally step outside of yourself, and all of your inhibitions sort of fall to the wayside, and you feel really just liberated and empowered. And for me, as a performer, I first started performing in musical theater, and I was never playing myself, so I could
like
always...
Like in school or...?
In school, and then I did some professional work. And, okay. And so, you know, you're playing a character and you're always stepping out of yourself. And then...
What were some of your roles?
my big breaking role was Annie. But that was like my first time that I was ever on stage. And I knew, I was like,
okay, you were Annie.
I was Annie.
Wow.
It was, you know, like a smaller production, a regional production.
That's
but
still very impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the first time I was really on stage, and I knew that I needed to be on stage. I just fell in love with it.
That's not a little wallflower role.
No.
Yeah, it's a big role for a kid.
Yeah.
I was 10 when I did it, and I still think back and I was like, wow, that's a lot of responsibility and a lot of a show to carry on your shoulders.
What's your favorite song from Annie? I want both of you to answer.
Oh, I really love Maybe.
Yes.
I love Maybe. Same. And I mean, Hard Knock Life is incredible. I love, you know, that, I think that moment is really great. And then I love the little moment. Oh, I'm touching the mic. The little moment where the, like the young 20-something woman comes on stage with her suitcase and does it like, NYC,
yes.
just got here this morning. That, like, whatever her name is called.
I think that it kind of evolves as you get older, right? Like, I didn't appreciate Maybe at all when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then recently I was like, what was that one really pretty song in Annie? And I put it on while I was walking my dog. And then I was like, floored. Like, mm-hmm. how come everyone isn't covering this song? It's one of the most beautiful songs
it
I've
is,
written.
It's so gorgeous.
It's specific about what it's about, kind of.
It's a gorgeous song. And it's very, it's yeah. hard to
you
sing.
Because oh, yeah.
it kind of goes yes. in between like a head voice and a belt. And then, you know, has those intervals, which is, anyway, so.
Yeah.
Did you study singing?
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
I studied singing, but my dad is a sort of a rock R&B singer. He's got great technique, but I think it was important for my parents and for me at a young age, because rock and R&B and soul and blues and jazz were such an important part of my life, to never go too far in the direction of like the Broadway singer.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like
that was their influence.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my mom would like, you know, play T-Rex records, and like we would listen to like everything from like Caledonia to, you know, Zeppelin to the Beatles to Eartha Kitt and Etta James, and like we weren't, no offense to Julie Andrews or, you know, like beautiful Broadway voices, but like that just wasn't, we weren't listening to sopranos, we were listening to like gritty
yeah
right
singers.
But you naturally gravitated towards it a little more.
Towards what?
Towards the Broadway? It was just an easy forum or an easy outlet as a kid.
It was just something I saw Guys and Dolls on Broadway when I was young, and then I saw Into the Woods and Crazy for You, and I was just like, just obsessed that you could create that type of a world. And
Crazy for You. Love that show.
And then I think for me, like, going back to the idea of, like, you're playing a character on stage, which was always much easier for me to comprehend than, like, when I would play music with my friends. Starting around, like, sixth grade, I had a really good group of guy friends, and they were in a ridiculous band called Twisted Dog Sister. and like, they wanted me to sing whole covers. And we were having, there was like a show at the local ice cream parlor and on our main street in town, and they wanted me to sing, you know, whole covers. And I was mortified. Like, the idea of having to sing as myself in front of my friends was terrifying. When people used to ask me to, like, sing on class trips, they'd be like, oh, we're driving from, you know, New Jersey to DC. I grew up in Jersey. They'd be like, sing for us. And, like, the idea of singing an Alanis Morissette song in front of my peers was, you know, it was awful. So musical theater was, like, very easy for me to step into and not be self-conscious. And then it took me a long time, really, until Sleigh Bells, to get to the point where I could go on stage as myself and not just want to, like, turn bright red and run off the stage.
But some part of you must have been wanting to do that if... You were putting yourself out there enough that people were having you in their bands.
I did. I did definitely want... I didn't like the fact that I... You know, I'd watch other performers and I would see them just be so raw and uninhibited. And I really wanted that. I would just always feel incredibly self-conscious. So it's something I had to work towards.
Yeah.
And I think the music of Sleigh Bells, the sort of cacophony and the intensity... the bombast of Sleigh Bells demands a front woman that is going to meet that challenge. Like, it's not shoegazy music. It's not quiet, sort of like stand there and look at your feet. Like, it just,
Sleigh Bells,
I was like,
makes
all right,
me want to, like, quit my job and go rage through the street and just, like, fuck up society.
Yeah, exactly. It makes me feel that way too. So I was like, all right, Alexis, you need to just get out of your own head here. And now I love it. There's nothing more exciting to me than those moments before I step on stage. Like, it's just, my adrenaline is off the charts. I think of it as like an athlete or a warrior going to battle. Like, it's just a very visceral, intense experience.
Yeah.
And I've totally embraced it now.
Like, do you have, like, an athlete does, like, a pumping up situation, like, or
yeah, I mean, I don't have
a ritual,
like, a specific routine. There's been jumping rope, there's been lots of cartwheels, anything that's going to raise my cardio, because I definitely can't go on stage just like, oh, I'm just chilling, drinking a beer, and then I start stomping around, I'm like, you know, so I, like, really have to, like, run up some stairs, or just lots of running in place, and, like I said, jumping jacks, and just being an idiot in general. Like, crew guys will be like, what is this maniac doing? Like, why?
Yeah, but they must see weirder shit than that.
I'm sure. But it's a very physically demanding show.
Yeah.
And I tend to stay quite healthy on tour, because I think of it as, like, you know, my favorite performers are physical performers, and whether it's modern day performers like Beyonce, who's kind of, you know, like, the ultimate queen of that, to James Brown, to even, you know, Otis Redding, like, every girl group, I love choreography, I love, you know, dynamic shows, entertainers. I have no issues with just, like, standing and watching a rock band. I love that too. But for me, like, I want to see movement and I want to be entertained.
Yeah.
So I try to do that. I mean, we don't have, like, dance routines on stage, although I would love to.
Different direction for the band.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're working on a new record right now, and that's something I'm going to pitch to Derek. Be like, dance moves. Some choreographed dance moves.
Yeah, go back into that musical theater realm a little bit of a crossover.
Which he's so horrified by. Oh, musical theater's the worst thing ever.
So that's so interesting that you grew up in a home where it was like, rock and roll is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And musical theater is kind of like, no, let's stay away from that.
Was your dad in a band?
He was. He's still a full-time musician. Okay. Like he did a lot of stuff with the Stone Pony and like the Jersey Shore bar band scene. Cool. And there's so many great players down there. But
Is that the part of Jersey that you grew up in?
The Shore.
Wow. Yes,
the much maligned Jersey Shore.
No, but it's great music.
Yeah, there's a great history there. I actually didn't get into a lot of the local musicians, especially Bruce, until later on when I discovered his earlier catalog.
Your dad wasn't playing Bruce when you were growing up?
Not really. My dad, when I was in high school and elementary school, was like a huge blues head.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I discovered, like, you know, Greetings from Asbury Park and early Bruce stuff. Because growing up in Jersey, like in high school, everybody's like, oh, Born in the USA, Dancing in the Dark.
Right.
Those are great songs, don't get me wrong. But I was listening to like Clash and punk bands and just alternative stuff. And I was like, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So when I discovered,
sometimes you have to pick your era of an artist to really enter into them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like early Bruce, if you're like into Dylan or something, then you can like really relate to early Springsteen.
Exactly.
Kind of stuff,
So
was
but your... yeah, it was a rock. It was definitely like a rock and roll house. Yeah.
Was your mother into?
Oh
was
yeah,
she playing.
Well, my mom's not a musician, but she's always been a music fan. And you know, it's funny, we're watching that show Vinyl right now, the HBO show, and she's like, oh, I remember being at Max's Kansas City on such and such a night, and like, I remember the first time I saw the Dolls, and like, we get into really funny conversations because my fiance is a huge Ramones fan. And she'd be like, the Ramones never played CBs. Like, they were at Great Gildersleeves down the street, and like, they were a corny band. And Tyler, my fiance's like, no, they actually did play CBs because I've seen footage of it. And like, so they would just get into these crazy debates about, like, is the Clash a pop band or is the Clash a punk band? And, you know, which bands, like, my mom dated Jimmy Destri, who was the keyboard player for Blondie for many years. And they were all friends, so just like
did she grow up in the city?
Debbie, yeah, my parents are both from Brooklyn.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, just like the first time she saw Debbie, and she was, I guess my mom was like 19, and Debbie at that point was like 35, and she was like, couldn't believe that a woman could be 35 and look that way and be as badass as Debbie Harry was. So yeah, my parents are so much cooler than I am.
It's a rock and roll family.
I mean, you turned out okay. So were you always thinking music was going to be the thing that you ended up doing?
I think that was what was so exciting about musical theater and discovering that, because I realized, even though my father was a musician and I understood that, like seeing musicians and artists on stage in theatrical capacity was the first time that I was like, oh, wow, this is a living. Like, this is something people do for work. And as a kid, like there were children actors in musical theater, whereas there weren't like child rock stars necessarily, right. Unless you were a prodigy. So it just seemed like, oh, this is something I can get into.
Did you spend much time going to your dad's shows and stuff?
I would sing with my dad. Okay. Yeah, I would perform with my dad, everything from like One Fine Day and girl group stuff to like random Elvis songs. And
as like a little girl?
Yeah. And then when I got obsessed with Jagged Little Pill, I would like learn how to play the harmonica, and I would, you know, like play like Alanis Morissette and harmonica solos and sing Ironic with my dad, and people would be like, who is this little kid? But
that's awesome.
Yeah. So you saw him making a living at it.
I did.
It was like part of that world. You were in it.
Yeah. And I very much, I mean, it sounds strange to say, but from the age of like 10 to 16, I worked professionally, whether it was in musical theater or commercial work. And then I was part of a cast girl band that started as like a Nickelodeon project called the Gunk Girls. And girls plus funk equals gunk.
Nailed it.
And there was an era of like GAC and Guts and all of that.
It was definitely like the height of Nickelodeon's reign over, you know,
like teen,
the world of tweens. Yeah.
Right.
And that sort of morphed into a deal with a label called Adel America. And it was a girl band. I was the bass player, lead singer. And I worked very closely with a producer named Jeff Copeland, who still does a lot of incredible work. And him and I wrote a lot of music. And then there were three other women. And we were all friends, but it was very much a put-together band. And we were trying to push it creatively in a bit of a heavier direction, and the label really wanted like a shiny pop direction, kind of like the girl band that could go on tour with Backstreet Boys.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Like, it was just a very, and it just felt,
how old were you at
really
this point?
Disingenuous. I was a part of that from about 12 to 15, 16. It was fine when I was 12 and we were doing the whole Radio Disney thing. And then as I got older, I was just mortified by it, and which was sad because it was
the really, music that you were playing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
your parents are good. Like, I can't.
it was good pop music. Like, it was good pop music. But when I was in high school, I could care two shits about good pop music. And it really wasn't until like being in Sleigh Bells and starting to think about the challenge of writing a great pop song that I recognized how good a lot of that music was. But I was burnt out on the music industry by about 15 or 16.
That's not good.
And wait, when did you pick up the bass?
I picked up the bass because when I first auditioned for the Nickelodeon show, I auditioned with keyboards. I was raised playing classical piano.
Uh-huh.
And I played, you know, synth keys, and they were basically like, we need a bass player. Do you think you can play bass? And I came to the next audition playing bass. Like, I remember my dad.
Whoa. Did he teach you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because my dad's awesome. A great guitar player and a decent bass player. And, you know, I think being a great bass player is a very hard thing to be. I think being like a shitty bass player is probably like the easiest thing of all the instruments to play shittily. But I worked on it for many years, and, you know, I think I got to a level that was, you know, fairly decent. And so the band dissolved due to record label issues and all kinds of other issues.
So,
and
you didn't have to be the one to say, I'm out? It just kind of fell apart
on
its own?
Yes and no. Okay. There were business issues. And then there was also me just being like, I'm done.
Right. Like, you let's know, let just, it go.
Yeah.
Were you still in school at that point? Or had you taken a break?
Okay. I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college for some, you know, I stepped out of music. I was working as a wedding singer throughout college, which was phenomenal.
Where'd you go to school?
Marymount Manhattan College.
So okay.
Just south of here, in the 70s on the east side. And I stayed working in music, but I was not interested in pursuing a career in music anymore.
What is the wedding singer life like?
I like that.
Dude, it was incredible. I'm still good friends with a lot of musicians, and it's a company that does very high society weddings, bar mitzvahs. So we would play with, you know, some nights there would be a 5-piece band, some nights there would be a 12-piece band, like a great horn section and percussion and 3 great singers harmonizing, singing everything from like Ella Fitzgerald to Kanye West.
Right. top 40s.
But
are you with a different band and different vocalists every gig?
Sometimes. And then sometimes we would stick with the same band.
Okay.
And
but you have to be able to like click into them really quickly.
Yeah. Every week there would be a new song list based on the wedding or the party. And it was great for my chops. I learned a ton. It was a great way to work with other musicians. It was good money
it's
for
a great
college
gig,
kid. Like,
totally.
I would get on the subway in my evening gown.
Right.
With like my like mic stand and my like alcohol swabs to clean off the mic breath.
Were there any songs that were requested where you're like, oh, fuck.
No, it wasn't really a request situation because I feel like most of the people... It was just for such rich people.
Yeah.
It was more of...
Okay. Like, but you had a list.
Yeah. Right. There were definitely requests. I can't
like
think
some
of...
super schmaltzy stuff.
Well, we would always... We never... it's funny. My dad is like a Brooklyn Jew.
Uh-huh.
But he was adopted. So I'm like not technically Jewish. But I grew up, like I said, like my father, sort of like with Jewish culture. But I wasn't bat mitzvahed or anything like that. And we would have to sing like all of the Hebrew songs, which I was just such a hack at.
Megillah.
Yeah, like I never actually learned the lyrics. So I would just like, with the, and then a lot of times there'd be a request for like, oh, this one. And I would just look at mine like, like literally had no idea what the hell.
No, I'm Jewish, but I never went to Hebrew school. So that's like every time I go to synagogue is just faking it.
Yeah.
My whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there were a lot of like, do you remember like September? Mm-hmm. And like, I remember the first time we had to sing that and I was just like, I know this song because the song is ubiquitous, but I don't actually know
the words.
Yeah. So there was lots of just making shit up. There was a funny situation where there was that Kelly Clarkson song, Because of You, that was really popular.
Whoa, for weddings?
Yeah, exactly. Which, so the lyrics of that song are really dark.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because of you, I never strayed too far from the side or whatever.
Isn't it about, it's like her father fucking up her life?
Yes. It's about, it's about abusive parents and just like really fucked up stuff. So we got a request from a mother who wanted that to be her and her son's first dance for like a bar mitzvah.
That's amazing.
And my the woman I worked with, luckily she was the one who was singing the song, and she, I remember it was like on our way to go to the gig, and she was like, "I just realized what these lyrics are." Yeah. So she rewrote all the lyrics.
I bet they didn't even notice.
Because of you. Oh, they did it.
No, they obviously never paid attention. No, yeah, exactly.
That's, it's informative how often people don't.
Oh, it's like when politicians play Born in the USA at their rallies. It's like, it's very like un-American.
Chris Christie's like, rah.
Right.
You know, and Springsteen's like, please go away.
Yeah, exactly.
I went to a wedding once where one of the songs they played was Brick, which is.
Wait, the Ben Folds.
About abortion.
About abortion. Right. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, this is Ben Folds. No,
oh, man.
No, you don't play that. People just don't realize.
Yeah, no, they're like, that's, I mean, that's the power of, you know, great melodies and great arrangements and production, right?
Yeah.
Because people are like, oh, this, you know, because of you, it sounds like this beautiful love song. Oh, because of you in my life, you are wonderful, which is kind of what we changed the lyrics to.
I just heard Maren was talking about that, how he's not like a lyrics guy. He doesn't really listen. And I think I might be that way too. So like, I'm probably guilty of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think there's a way to listen and then you can click in or click out.
Right.
It.
Yeah.
And that's nice.
And I guess some musicians place more emphasis on their lyrics. I mean, they know when you can't really hear the lyrics very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I had this same conversation with Caroline from Chairlift, and she was saying like, if the lyrics aren't, like, it's all about the lyrics. I hear lyrics first.
So she's a lyrics person.
I was like, I hear melodies first.
Yeah.
You know, I can think of countless times, like growing up, when I would just had no idea what the heck I was singing. You know?
Yeah. Like,
even singing it, not just listening as a listener, but you can just
But that being said, I have tremendous respect for great lyrics. So.
Well, and you're a writer. I mean, how does that sit with you? The idea of people really appreciating the music, loving the music, but not necessarily even knowing.
It's kind of fine because I don't do most of the lyric writing in Sleigh Bells. I do most of like the melody, harmony, arranging. My bandmate does a lot of stream of consciousness writing, and he's since gotten like much more focused on lyric writing and has really excelled at it and is a much better lyricist than I am, especially for Sleigh Bells. Like I think the lyrics started off, especially on our first records, as almost textural, rhythmic, like embellishments, you know, things that would exist within all of the rhythm and the guitar and the melodies. And it was more about, like I said, you know, the lyrics being very rhythmic and less about them being narratives or telling a story, like very different than Bethany, right? For example,
right.
I'm sure her creative process, and then they've since evolved to be more introspective and more personal. And I really like the way that Derek and I work, because he'll give me, sometimes there'll be specific ideas, like I would like this to be a verse lyric, or I have this great idea for a chorus lyric, but he'll send me a sheet and I'll sit with the track and almost act like an editor, where I'll say, okay, I love this, let me grab that, this works together, and then just sort of create the song and the arrangement and the melodies with that sort of skeleton.
And what's there already? A melody, a beat?
Nothing.
A beat?
Beat and guitar. Okay. Yeah, production from, you know, it could be anything from, lately we've been doing, like he'll send me, he's finally started to work at home in Logic and has gotten really good at engineering himself. So now we'll have some more like fully fleshed out tracks that I'll sit down with. But in the past, it could be anything as simple as, you know, a guitar riff or, you know, a basic drum guitar combination. But I like, it's also this weird competitive thing that exists between us because he'll work on a track and he won't send it to me until he gets it to a place that he's very, very proud of. So he'll kind of hold off and be like, oh, I have this great new track. And I'm like, dude, just send it to me. And he's like, no, I got to keep working on it till it's good. So he'll send it to me in like this pretty, you know, it's obviously a rough mix, but it's pretty finalized. And I always get this like, oh my God, this is really good. Like, how am I going to sort of step up and meet this? And then I'll sit with it and I'll do like a full-on demo with harmonies, everything, like this is the vocal approach here, this is the delivery, like, and I'll send him a demo and there's always this like horrifying, you know, I'll text him like 10 minutes in advance, like, I'm sending you the demo, and I'll be like, okay. And then I'll like look at my phone to wait to see, right, like when the bubbles are showing up to be like, you know, and I can always tell if he's like, you know, 10 exclamation points, like, oh my God, this is incredible, I love it, or if it's like,
cool,
great, .. You know, like you can always tell. And but it works out really well for us. Normally, I think we always have, or as of late, have really been delivering each other things that we're very impressed by and proud of. And I think that competitive thing that exists between us, sort of brother-sister dynamic, is really healthy because, you know, nothing's worse, or nothing's more of a motivator than somebody saying to you, like, I think you can do better work. And nothing's more exciting than when the person whose opinion you value so much says, like, this is great.
Yeah. So you guys will get real with each other like
that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Derek and I have gotten to a point where, obviously, we're not doing things to hurt each other's feelings. We're never malicious with one another. But I think for a band to be successful and survive, you have to really get through all of the bullshit. Like, there can't be resentments, there can't be passive aggressiveness, because those have been the most toxic times in our band's relationship, when one of us withholds information from the other, or, you know, lets a resentment build. And especially with songwriting, I mean, it's very vulnerable, like being told that what you're doing isn't as good as the person thinks it should be is a terrible thing to hear. It's crushing. But I think 95% of the time, if I express an opinion regarding his production and if he expresses an opinion regarding my vocal work, even though it stings at first, it pushes us to do better work. And that's really been the story of this most recent record that we're working on. It's just like, we had a tendency in the past to work on something, to love it, and to put it out. And then months would go by and we would sit with it and say, like, maybe we shouldn't have put that out. You know, maybe we should have spent more time with it and worked on it. And then we started really sort of studying the history of so many great records that took years and years to make. And this record is, I feel like, that record for us. We've had songs that we've sent to our management or played for people and be like, this is the best thing you've ever heard. And people will be like, yeah, it's cool. And we're like, fuck you, you guys are idiots. And then, you know, 6 months go by and we're like, all right, you know, like, this song needs work.
Yeah. So you're really giving it that amount of breathing room. Like, yeah, you'll feel like something is ready to show to people and then not put it out and sit with it.
Definitely. We've had we recorded a track last week. It's one of my favorites that we've done. And this is after thinking the record was done months ago. So we're still writing for that reason. And it was a song that had existed as a fully recorded, completed, arranged song about a year ago, and then kind of morphed into something else about 6 months ago. And then we just put it on the shelf because we were like, this is over. And then we took some of the lyrics and rewrote the melodies, and Derek totally revamped the production, and now it's a completely different beast that we could never have imagined existing when we had that first version of it. So that's that's something that we've been really pushing ourselves to do. It's a tricky process, though, because sometimes you do have something that's really good and you just need to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And knowing when to stop tweaking is tricky.
Right.
I'm sure deadlines are good.
Deadlines help.
Yeah.
But are you in a new place because of where, how many albums you have put out and then level of success that you have reached that now you are able to say, we're going to take our time. We're not going to be rushed for this reason or that reason. Yeah. You know,
I think that's finally sunk into us. We were fighting that for a while, feeling like if we don't put something out, we're not going to stay relevant, or this industry is so competitive, like people are going to forget about us, like we need to get something out. And we've since realized, like, okay, the most important thing here is the record. Like, there will be a time and a place to tour it, to put it out. We have to find the right situation so that we make sure that when we put this out, it makes the biggest impact, and just take our time and not let our own sort of insecurities and needs. And also, we just miss touring, you know, so there's mm-hmm. definitely this, right. Like, let's get it out.
Yeah. I heard the new track, Champions of Unrestricted Beauty.
Uh-huh.
It sounds different from your other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So is this album generally in that new direction, or is just that track?
That track is not a representation of the rest of the record.
Okay.
We're planning on putting out a track soon that I think will make that very obvious.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I feel like we blew past, first of all, the whole idea of noise pop and the label of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I say that, like, the new track sounds different, I think what I mean is it's like less noise and more pop.
Sure.
And we like debate the meaning of labels, and Star has her own struggle with it with her band too, and in general. When did noise pop come into your guys' consciousness?
Like, when journalists started calling us noise pop. Okay. You know, like, there was
that even a thing before Sleep? Like, what? Who else is a noise pop band?
I don't know.
Right?
I mean, I feel like every new band that's getting attention and, you know, on blogs and on the internet, you know, journalists need to describe them.
Right.
And we were called everything from rap rock to, pop metal. And then I think people just sort of settled on noise pop.
Was the catchiest and sort of most fitting.
I think Treats was a very loud, noisy record. There was a lot of distortion and and the same thing with Reign of Terror, Bitter Rivals a little less so. And now I think we do both. I think there's definitely been a focus on becoming better songwriters, which I feel like has pushed things in a more pop direction in terms of arrangement and in terms of how I'm using my voice.
Yeah, we can hear you more on that track, for example. Yeah,
definitely. And that's a result of us sort of taking over the writing process as equals. But I think for anybody who is worried that we've sort of lost the heaviness and the aggression and the guitar and like the anthemic quality of some of our music, need not worry. But it was a challenge. Like, we put that song out not as a single, just as like, all right, let's just put a song out because why not? Like,
yeah.
But we have a Twitter account, and like, if I was a fan, I'd be like, yo, Slaybells, let's hear something. And we didn't necessarily pick a song that was going to be like the smartest song to put out or that would appeal to the most amount of people. That song for us has been a little bit of an outlier and just something that we loved and wanted to share with people. So we've been making decisions that maybe aren't the most business savvy decisions.
Do you have people on your team who are like advising you to go in a different direction, but you guys say, let's...
Derek and I, we have a great team of people, but Derek and I at this point have like really decided that we're just going to take the reins and make these creative decisions, not because we want to make them because they feel right. And maybe they're impulsive, but that's okay. This whole idea of being strategic about the songs that you release for the sake of radio or labels or streaming. Like, I think there's so many things for artists to consider nowadays, and it's very overwhelming. And I think we went through a period where we were really focused on like doing the right thing. And it didn't compromise our music because we didn't put a record out based on those principles. But we've now gotten to the point where we're like, you know what? There's no rules, and we need to do what we want. And that's how this band started. This band started as us making music that we wanted to make and putting it on the internet, and people being like, "What the? What is this?" Yeah,
it's a very well known story, but I'd still like to hear a little bit in detail about that fateful day.
Oh gosh,
I know you're so sick of telling the story, but it's fascinating, and also because then I know just going forward from that. I mean, it was like MySpace that you guys were then discovered, right?
Yeah, which doesn't seem that long ago, but my God, how long ago?
Yeah,
yeah.
And also just what. You know, speaking about a journalist sort of putting that noise pop categorization on you, mm-hmm. like when you met Derek, what was he presenting you with? How did he describe the music? And so just take
and
just
a little
bit.
Was it already that sound? Yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah.
When Derek and I met, I was teaching. I was part of a program called Teacher America. I was a fourth grade public school teacher in the Bronx. And met him on my summer break between my first and second year teaching at a restaurant with my mom.
So were you already getting burned out? Because I know Teach for America is hard.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I think, what, it's like 2 or 3 year burnout rate?
Yes.
From what I remember from my friends.
I wasn't getting burnt out. I was more motivated than ever to make my second year successful in the classroom. And mm-hmm. I had a very successful second year.
Cool.
It was a challenge for me to leave it behind.
Wow.
I loved it. I, at that point, didn't know if I could continue on for 5-10 years in the classroom without getting into a whole analysis of the education system and why right. teacher burnout exists.
Yeah.
I will say that, yes, you are working your ass off and you are very, depending on your school, mostly working unsupported. So there were a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
I was not looking for an out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hard decision for me to make.
Were you dreaming of what would come after teaching?
Sure. Which was for me probably going to be work in educational policy, continued work within education at that point. And met Derek. It was the summer. I hadn't really thought about music other than teaching my kids music because I was just so busy. And through our conversation at dinner, my mom was asking Derek many questions, found out he was from Florida originally. They started talking about Florida, which is where she is also from, half Florida, half Brooklyn, and asked him what he was doing in Brooklyn. He said he was a musician, that he had moved up here because he was trying to start a band. she asked him what kind of band. He was like, well, I'd love to work with a female vocalist.
Is this something that your mom just says a lot?
No, it's not. It was a very serendipitous thing. Like, this was not... Like, my mom was not shopping me around, right. Like, being like, hey, my daughter can sing. Like, join a band with her.
No, or that she just, like, chatted up waiters all the time.
I mean, my mom's very friendly. Like, yeah. She's very talkative. Yes, she does chat up waiters a lot. and servers, or anybody. Like, she's just one of those very curious people. Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily pitching you as a singer.
No. It just so happened that he started talking about music, and she was like, oh, you know, you guys should work together. And
were you like, Mom?
Oh, I was mortified. I was, you know, very, very mortified.
And what a badass mom. She's like, my daughter's, you know, teaching, but do music together.
Yeah, seriously. So, yeah. My mom would be like, she's a teacher. Look away.
Right. And my mom, you know, it's interesting. My parents always were very proud of my transition to academics and education, but they missed me being involved in music. Like, it was sort of the opposite of what a lot of parents would encourage their children to do. Like, my mom, when I came down to the decision to, like, leave teaching, she was very supportive. You know, she said, you can always go back to the classroom. You know, you have your degrees, you have your resume. Those things aren't going to go away. You have an opportunity to make music with somebody, and you may not have that opportunity again.
Good job, Mom.
Yeah. So my parents were pushing me, not pushing me, but my parents were encouraging me to pursue music again.
Yeah.
So Derek took her bait. Like, totally took her bait and was like, really? What? You're a singer? What? Tell me, what do you do? And I was like, whoa. Let me tell you about my background in teen pop music.
Are you and Derek around the same age?
We are. He's a little older than I am. And he had just left a band called Poison the Well, which was a hardcore band. And they had toured extensively and put out many records. And so he was totally burnt out on that and was looking to do something new. So we actually had some common, you know, common experiences with just being over the version of the music industry that we had experienced. Mm-hmm. So he said to me, like, here's my email. Why don't you get in touch with me if you want to hear some of the stuff I'm working on? And I got home that night, and against all, you know, rational thought, I emailed him and I sent him, because I had worked, in addition to working as a wedding singer, I'd done a lot of work as a demo singer, which was fascinating. So I would record mostly pop songs, because those are the artists that are not writing their own material. But songwriters would hire me to demo versions of songs, and then they would be pitched to artists. So
I don't know if I knew that was a job.
Yeah, it is cool. A job. It is definitely a job. And it was wonderful. So I had a lot of songs that I had recorded, not as, you know, Alexis Krauss, but as Alexis Krauss, you know, singing a song for Britney Spears or whoever it was. So I sent everything to him. He really loved my voice.
Had you checked him out at that point?
Yeah, just sort of like, I knew of Poison the Well. He told me a little bit about his background, but he hadn't done any of his own production work at that point. So it's not like I could look up Derek Miller and hear anything. Mm-hmm. Nothing was public. So we got together. It just so happened he lived 3 blocks away from me in Greenpoint. So we met at McGorlick Park in Greenpoint, and it was like kind of awkward. I was like, hey, and he was like, here's my laptop, and like gave me some headphones, and I listened to a very early demo of Infinity Guitars.
What?
And
what year was this?
I should be better at years. 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, 2008. Because I taught from 2007 to 2009. Yeah.
Cool.
So
were there vocals on it?
So there was actually, he had done some work with like a friend of a friend down in Florida. And on one version of Infinity Guitars, there was like this very, it was totally different, but this kind of like shouted vocal on it. And the whole thing just sounded unlike anything I had heard. And I was very, very intrigued by it and really curious about how I could use my voice in a project like that, because it was just very different than anything I had sung before. And I was up for the challenge. And I was like, you know what? I have time. Like, it's July. I'm not working. So let's try recording some stuff. And that's how it started. That summer, we would just go to his apartment or my apartment, and we would set up. At first, we would just set up the laptop and record direct into GarageBand.
Wow.
And then we got a mic and got a little setup going. And
was your dad like, no. How are you guys doing this?
No, I mean, my dad's never been an engineer. So he was just like, why not? Sounds good. Technology, you know, computers, like, great. And we certainly weren't, you know, paying for studio time.
Yeah.
I lived in Greenpoint at that time as well, and my old Polish landlord would come down and bang on my door because we would record after work around between 7 and 9 p.m. and he thought something terrible was happening to me because I would be like screaming because a lot of stuff on Treats has a lot of, you know, screaming or shouting. He'd be like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine, I'm just singing. He's like, this is not Bing Crosby. This is,
how long did it take to get into that groove?
It didn't take that long. I think because I had done a lot of session work and I was very comfortable sort of stepping outside of my comfort zone and singing, going back to that idea of becoming a character, right? Like, I wasn't so concerned about emoting and being myself. I liked the idea of occupying a different headspace. So when I was singing a song like Crown on the Ground or Infinity Guitars, or, you know, then jumping to something like Real, like I liked this idea of sort of divorcing my own interpretation and trying to meet the demands of the music.
Yeah. Can we geek out about Real for a second? This is my favorite sleigh bell song. Uh-huh. So, okay, it's sampling a Funkadelic song.
It is, yeah. Can you get to that?
Yes, which is an amazing song, but, I mean, Real, like, adds so much to it. So how does that process, like, can you just talk about how you guys put that song together?
It was an exercise in sampling.
Yeah.
And as a producer, it was the first time Derek had, you know, had a moment in music that he loved, you know, that riff from Can You Get to That,
yeah.
And was trying to, you know, essentially build a beat around it. So it just started off as just an experiment. And then I remember like sitting at my kitchen table and working on us, you know, we're like editing the lyrics to that and figuring out a range, and the intonation of that Funkadelic guitar part is so strange. So we recorded like a higher version and a lower version, and then like a more push delivery and like a less. So that song just took us months and months to like really get it together.
Was it easy to get their permission?
Well, it was very all very naive at first, right? And we we have to clear this right. sample. And there was a moment when it was not looking like that. It was looking like that song was not going to be on the record. They were not happy. I don't want to say they were not happy, but they were not making it easy for us to clear that sample.
Yeah.
Had you produced the song before signing with a label or doing anything like that?
We had a version of it that we put on MySpace, and then when we signed with Mom and Pop, we went into the studio officially and worked with Shane Stoneback, who is our dear friend and who engineered the first record, and we, you know, re-recorded it there. And yeah, it almost didn't clear, and the terms of the negotiations are not in our favor. So it was more about getting the song out than it was about making a penny. On
yes,
it.
Got it.
Which is fine.
But I'm so glad it exists.
Yes.
Exactly. So are we. And we thought about like, oh, how are all the, you know, what ways can we get around this? Can we re-record it? Can we change it? And it just wouldn't have been the same.
Mm-hmm. Was Mom and Pop supportive of that whole process?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Nice. They really loved the song and they were great advocates for it. So
awesome.
But you know, sample clearance is not something that we're really interested in after that experience.
Right. It's not a fun world to dwell in.
Yeah. And we're just interested now in making our own.
There you go.
So
your recording and learning each other's styles and
right.
and collaborating towards a style together.
Right.
And then you start putting the songs on MySpace.
Yes.
And what was the idea? What was your expectation at that point? And are you still going back to teaching? Are you thinking like this is a fun side thing? Or when did it evolve into being this is going to be it?
Well, there was a point in time, I guess it was around February or March, when I needed to tell my principal if I was coming back or not coming back. And so I told her that I was not going to be coming back. And
did you tell her why?
Yeah. Yeah. They were cool with it. You know, no one, they understood. Or they said they understood. Probably thought I was crazy. Because it was also like 2008 and the economy had just gone to crap.
Yeah, were you going towards...
That's a good point.
Not having a day job at that point and just
saying...
Oh, yeah. Like,
the plan was I was going to wait tables, which is what I did. I started working in my neighborhood, waiting tables. The last 2 months that I was teaching, I was waiting tables and teaching, which was fun, and working on the band. And then when my teaching job ended and I was about to get tenure, I was about to get a salary increase. It was a
You're
chance. I took a chance. Mm-hmm. And then things started happening quickly in the sense that the right people started hearing our music. Spike Jones heard our songs and then played them for MIA, and we got contacted by MIA very early on. Like, just a lot of surreal things.
Right, when you hear that story, right, how did that...
Does MIA call you?
Or how did Spike Jones even? I mean, was it because of Poison the Well?
It was through a friend who was writing for like a blog that Spike was curating at that point, essentially, for a short film that he was working on. And so he heard the song through that. And then I think the story is... I saw Spike not too long ago and we were talking about this, but I think the story was he was at a party and Maya was at the party and he was like, "Have you heard this band?" And like played her, maybe it was Crown on the Ground, I don't remember, over an iPhone speaker, which I'm sure that sounded great. And she was excited by it and emailed Derek, and actually emailed the wrong Derek Miller. And then that email was magically forwarded by the other Derek Miller to the right Derek Miller.
No.
In just like a weird, totally fateful. Yeah.
Yeah. So the universe stepped in things. And they were like, "We don't want this to get fucked up.
Right.
Send it to the right person."
And Derek called me while I was at work waiting tables and was like freaking out because MIA for him was a huge, huge influence. And
yeah,
we met up
sense.
With her. We started talking about, she was had a label at that time called Neat, and started talking with her about getting music out via Neat. And then we were invited to play a couple of shows from friends of ours who were playing like small CMJ showcases in Brooklyn. Played a couple shows. Sasha Fair Jones of The New Yorker happened to be at one of those shows, wrote about us in The New Yorker. Couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
You know, it was luck. There was a lot of hard work involved, don't get me wrong, but there was a lot of luck as well. Just the right shows at the right time, being heard by the right people. Pitchfork picked it up. We did a show at the Market Hotel. They wrote about it. And then suddenly there were labels asking to sign our band.
And when did you quit that serving job?
I guess I stopped right before we went on tour, which would have been... I think we started touring. First tour was with Major Lazer, and then we did a tour with Yay Sayer, and then our record came out in May. So I probably went on tour around January.
Okay.
So
you're
I was waiting
about
tables
it.
From like May to January,
yeah.
Which when you consider how many years people have to work to get their music heard, it's really grateful. You know, we're really grateful that it worked out like it did.
How was the transition from making these recordings to then presenting that as a live show?
Oh, it was a total shit show at first. People would just, they were like, they called us a karaoke band because it was essentially Derek playing live guitar, our iPod playing the tracks, and me singing.
So this is 2010, really, mm-hmm. that it started. So
yeah. Yeah, we didn't have a band. We didn't have a crew. It was Derek and I and our manager, and then my fiance, you know, plugging in pedals and talking to the sound guy and be like, the mix is going to sound a little weird, but can you make sure that you do X, Y, and Z? And then, you know, just thinking the sound of the band was totally sort of ass backwards. But yeah, it was,
I mean, now just, that seems, you know, you see that a bunch. It's not unusual now, but I feel like that in 2010, it was a little bit.
It was definitely, there was still more of a disconnect between, or still more of a division, I should say, between the audiences that wanted to go see a band and then the audience that wanted to see an electronic act.
Right.
So people didn't know if we were an electronic act or if we were a band. And we would kind of say, like, well, we're not really a band. Like, the electronic elements of our band are very powerful. Like, we're not interested in recreating all these sounds live. And we wanted the energy in the room to sort of be similar to that of a DJ night, where it was less about standing there and, you know, worshiping the musicianship and more about the experience of the music and just letting go and being uninhibited. And obviously we both had connections to the hardcore scene and the punk scene, and we wanted the shows to be sort of raw and raucous and fun. And I think they ended up becoming that. And then we've since started playing with another guitarist who have always been dear friends of ours. Right now, our last tour, we were playing with Ryan Primack, who was also our production manager. And then before that, we were playing with Jason Boyer, who's a great musician and a great friend. And then Chris Maggio plays drums for us now. And he's just a beast of a drummer. He can actually keep up with the electronic drums and sounds, which we still, you know, blast through the speakers, because we're never going to be a totally live band. It doesn't work with our sound. So I think we found a nice balance, but that balance came with resources, you know, came with being able to pay a crew and other musicians. So there were definitely times when the iPod would skip, and then we started running things through a laptop, and the laptop would freeze, and I had to do a lot of, there were moments in the show where Derek would look at me and be like, talk.
Right.
You know, that was the much dreaded word.
It is.
Talk. Okay. Sure. Hi. Let me tell you a joke. I don't tell jokes.
I identify the show Girls with you guys a lot.
Uh-huh.
But how many songs have you actually had on that show?
I know Bitter Two? Rivals was on. And then there was another song I can't remember right now. I think it was Infinity.
Yeah, was I think it. So. Was it like really early? Pretty early, I want to say.
Yeah, and then they used, I think, Bitter Rivals for.
Yeah, wasn't
Marnie,
like a Marnie
was like working out
exactly.
It
just seems like a really good marriage that I can like remember the scenes when I hear the sleigh bell songs in that show.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to go well together, and with the whole Brooklyn thing, like this new Brooklyn moment.
Yeah, that sort of girls Brooklyn zeitgeist. Kind of,
yeah, exactly.
For sure. I mean, TV has been really important to us in general, TV and film.
Yeah.
Sofia Coppola used Crown on the Ground. We just had like a great Jessica Jones sync for Demons.
Sofia Coppola.
The Bling Ring.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we've always been really happy to license our music for those purposes. I think it's been a dream come true to have a director like Sofia Coppola, you know, say, oh, we like your song, let's use it. And then also, having somebody like Lena Dunham and her team respect the band and like the band is huge. And I think today, I mean, that's how a lot of people discover music. You know, they hear a song and they're like, what's that? And then they look it up. So we've been really fortunate to get a lot of great opportunities like that, commercial, film, TV. So,
yeah. Whatever you guys can do, right? That's the game.
And you know what? We've always been like, we're not interested in our band being exclusive. We want it to be inclusive.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a 12-year-old girl sitting at home watching TV and an iPhone commercial comes on and she hears Real Real and then she comes to a show, great. Like, I'm much more interested in her opinion than I am in you know, the like stuffy 35-year-old white dude standing in the back, like with his arms crossed, you know, mm-hmm. thinking about our musicianship or whatever. Right. Like, yeah. you know, like we love all of our fans, but I don't care how you discover us. Of course. You know, if you are a fan of the music and you want to come to a show, please come to a show.
Yeah.
You know?
So on that note, the new album is coming out at some point this year, but we don't have a date.
Yeah, at some point this year. It's been frustrating not to be able to say when exactly, but it's coming out. I mean, it's essentially...
Do you know, but you can't say?
No, I don't know.
Like, how much can we torture you to get this information out of you?
I don't know. Okay. I can tell you that, you know, we'll be releasing music soon. Cool. It's just a matter of, you know, figuring out the right way to go about it.
Good for you guys. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then do you plan to tour around it or?
Hoping to, definitely, we'll definitely be touring around it. Hopefully next year we'll have a pretty busy tour schedule. I'm very much looking forward to getting back on tour.
What are your favorite festivals or things to play?
I love playing Coachella. I think it's a great festival. It's a big festival for us. We've had a wonderful history there. I'm less of a festival person and more of like a small sweaty club show person. Cool. Like I love the 9:30 Club. Sasquatch is actually a great festival. Like in thinking of festivals, I mean, we've had lots of wonderful festival situations, but generally the energy that you can cultivate in a room,
the clubs, yeah,
where it's your own show and you're headlining, is in my opinion more special. But yeah, I'm just excited to bring this stuff on the road. I miss it. I miss playing.
We're excited.
Cool. Yeah. And then you have this mystery thing with Bethany.
Mystery Bethany Gonatrix. So. Well, it's interesting.
Bonding like, and
Gana. We both came upon your video together.
Uh-huh.
You have a little car driving.
Oh,
video.
Yeah. Our Ford Focus commercial. Yeah.
Branding.
Yeah, we like, separately, like, right, came I mean, to it and we're like, wow.
It's things like that that make trips to Ghana possible or like making a record possible.
Word. Totally.
You know how it is.
Oh, yeah. The business is also great.
Thank you.
I mean, no, that's the crazy thing, especially these days. It's like the lines are so blurred.
It didn't feel like a commercial. I mean,
no. Well, and it's not a commercial, right. But it serves that purpose for them, but it also serves other purposes.
It's like, so it's have you ever watched comedians in cars?
Oh, yeah.
And they just like the way that the ads, I mean, obviously, like it's an ad for the car, but like then they'll just like stop in the middle of the road. It's like, that car is in my way. That's a Ford or whatever, you know?
It's right, just
like,
right.
It's name just, drop. Right. Yeah. It doesn't have to be, it can be funny. It can be in any way. So I know, but that was great.
Everyone wins.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm all about, obviously you have to have standards and you have to have integrity and we're not going to say yes to every brand, but yeah, I get to drive around in a car and have cool conversations about women with
exactly.
Bethany.
Like,
and we get that. And as your fans, we get that.
Yeah.
We get the two of you talking
right.
in this, like in a really well-produced segment is and
right.
there's no harm in that.
Yeah, and right. I also think like you know there's no such thing in my opinion as selling out nowadays. Like musicians are engaging with media, social media, corporate media in a lot of different ways. And like I said, you know, we're not selling hundreds of thousands of records. Like if we want to make a record, like we need to pay for it. And there's lots of things that Derek and I have done with our Ford Focus money to like help put the record out. So I have no issues with being like, yeah, sure. Like I'm trying to, you know, pay my rent. Like no issues with that. So it's just
power
funny.
To you. That's awesome. We're yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Soul Sisters brought to you by Ford Focus. For listening, guys. It's never too late. Step
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But literally, like, it was the bonding that Bethany and I did over that led to our Ghana bonding.
So great.
Led to our other great series, Bonding in Ghana.
Yeah. Yes. So, guys, we will later today talk to Bethany about her version of this Ghana bonding.
Yes.
See what she has to say about it. Sounds like an STD. Ghana bonding.
There was crying, there was laughing, there was all kinds of funny things. So
fun times.
But we will be it's a project with Vice and with Live Nation TV.
Oh,
so
rad.
I can say that. And
cool. Is there a time we can expect that?
In a couple months.
Great.
Yeah, April ish.
All right. So wonderful. Lots of big things this year.
Yes, it's going to be a big year. I'm really excited. And, you know, we're just, for the fans out there, we're just trying to get it all right. We've recorded more songs than we've ever recorded. And, you know, it's I was like reading something that Kendrick Lamar said the other day about performing new songs on TV. And he's like, I have so many songs that didn't make the record that I still love. And we're kind of in that position now where it's like,
we're cutting.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we have a lot of tracks that we love and we're trying to find a place for them or just trying to be smart about which ones we hold on to and which ones we don't. I mean, but there'll always be tracks that you love. Like it's the same thing with, Bruce is doing the tour on the river right now, and there's like a song that I think Loose Ends, which is one of my favorite Springsteen songs, and I just watched his HBO documentary talking about like the rationale for keeping some songs and cutting other songs. And you know, he's like, but we love all these songs, so we just had to put another version of it out however many years later.
Yeah, I know, I was gonna say, so like in 40 years you guys can right, then like surprise us with these songs.
Right.
Yeah. Very cool.
So I think that's just part of the process.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, Alexis, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh,
thank
of course.
You. This was
we'll
awesome.
See you tonight.
Yes, I will be there.
All right.
Be there.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.